Each of the other three was air, woven almost delicately around each woman, binding her arms to her sides. Lifting them was not precisely difficult, but not easy either. A clamor rose on the ship as the women floated into the air and out over the river. Egwene heard the boatman moaning. She was not interested in him. The three seafolk women did not even kick. With an effort, she hoisted them higher, some 10 or 12 paces above the surface. No matter how hard she strained, that seemed to be the limit. Well, you don't want to actually hurt them, she thought, and released the weaves. They'll scream now. The seafolk women curled into balls as soon as they began to fall, spun, straightened with their arms thrust out before them. They entered the water with three quite small splashes. Moments later, three dark heads broke the surface, and the women began swimming rapidly back toward the ship. Egwene closed her mouth. If I haul them up by their ankles and dunk their heads, they'll... What was she thinking? They had to scream because she had? She was no wetter than they. I must look like a drowned rat. She channeled carefully. Working about yourself always took care. You could not see the flows clearly, and water rolled off her, oozed out of her garments. It made quite a puddle. It was the boatman staring at her, mouth hanging open and eyes wide, that made her realize what she had done. Channeled! In the middle of the river! With nothing to hide her from any Aes Sedai who happened to be where she could see. Sun or no sun, she suddenly felt cold to the bone. You may take me back to shore now. No telling who was on the docks. At this distance, she could not tell a man from a woman. Not to the city, the riverbank. The fellow flung himself against his oars so hard she almost fell over backward. He took her to a spot where the shore was all smooth rocks the size of her head. There was no one in sight, but she leaped out as soon as the boat grated onto the rocks, hoisted her skirts, and darted up the sloping bank at a dead run she maintained all the way back to her tent, where she collapsed in a panting pile of sweat. She did not go near the city again, except to meet Gawain, of course. The days passed, and the now almost ceaseless wind carried waves of dust and grit day and night. On the fifth night, Bear accompanied Egwene into the world of dreams, just a quick jaunt in the nature of a test, a walk in the part of Telairunriod that Bear knew best, the Aiel Waste, a parched, jagged land that made even drought-torn Cairhien seem lush and fair. A quick trip, and then Bear and Amys came to wake her and see whether it had had any ill effect. It had not. No matter how they made her run and jump, no matter how often they peered into her eyes and listened to her heart, they agreed. But agreement or not, the next night Amys took her for another short trip to the waste, followed by another examination that made her glad to crawl onto her pallet and fall into a deep sleep. Those two nights she did not return to the world of dreams, but it was more exhaustion than anything else. Before that she had told herself every night she should stop. A fine thing if she was caught violating their strictures just when they were ready to lift them. But somehow she always decided that just a short trip would be all right, quick enough to reduce the chance of exposure. One thing she did avoid was the place between Telairunriod and the waking world, the place where dreams floated. Especially she avoided it after she found herself thinking that if she was very careful, she might be able to peek into Gawain's dreams without being drawn in, and that even if she was pulled in, it would only be a dream. She reminded herself firmly that she was a grown woman, not a silly girl. She was just glad no one else knew what a snarl the man made of her thoughts. Amys and Bear would laugh till they cried. On the seventh night she prepared herself for bed, carefully, putting on a fresh shift and brushing her hair till it shone. All useless so far as Telairunriod was concerned, but it kept her from thinking about how her stomach was doing backflips. Tonight it would be Aes Sedai waiting in the heart of the stone, not Nynaeve or Elaine. That should make no difference, unless... The ivory-backed hairbrush froze in mid-stroke. Unless one of the Aes Sedai revealed that she was only accepted. Why had she not thought of that before? Light, but she wished she could talk with Nynaeve and Elaine. Only she could not see what good it would do, and she was certain that dream of breaking things meant something would go badly wrong if she did speak to them. Chewing her lip, she considered going to Amice and telling her she was not feeling well. Nothing serious, just an upset stomach, but she did not think she could visit the dream tonight. They were going to start her lessons again after tonight's meeting, but another lie, and a coward's way to boot. She would not be a coward. Not everyone could be as brave as everyone else, but cowardice was despicable. Whatever happened tonight, she had to make herself face it, and that was that. Firmly, she put down the brush, blew out the lamp, and crawled onto her pallet. She was tired enough that falling asleep presented no problem, though if necessary she knew how to put herself to sleep at any time now, or enter a light trance where she could be in the world of dreams and still talk, well, mumble, to someone waiting by her body. The last thing before sleep came, she realized something surprising. Her stomach was not turning over anymore. She stood in a great vaulted chamber forested with thick columns of polished redstone, the heart of the stone in the stone of Tyr. Gilded lamps hung from chains overhead, unlit, but there was, of course, light, coming from everywhere and nowhere. Amice and Bear were already there, looking no different than they had that morning, except that all their necklaces and bracelets sparkled a bit more than even gold really should have. They were talking quietly and looking irritated. Egwene caught only a word here and there, but two of them were Randall Thor. Abruptly, she realized she was wearing an accepted white dress with the banded hem. As soon as she did, it became a copy of the Wise One's garb, without jewelry. She did not think the other two women had noticed, or would know what the dress meant if they did. There were times when surrender lost less G and earned less To than the alternatives, but no Aiel would ever consider it without even trying to fight. "They are late again," Amice said wryly, walking out into the open space beneath the chamber's great dome. Driven into the floorstones there was what appeared to be a sword made of crystal, Kalandor of prophecy, a male Sangreal, and one of the most powerful ever made. Rand had put it there to remind the tyrants of him, as if there was any chance of them forgetting. But Amice barely glanced at it. To others, the sword that is not a sword might be a symbol of the dragon reborn. To her, it was a Wetlander concern. "At least we can hope they will not try to pretend they know everything and we nothing. They were much better last time." Theirs snort would have made Cerulea blink. "They will never be better. The least they can do is be where they said they would be when they said that—" She cut off as seven women appeared suddenly on the other side of Kalandor. Egwene recognized them, including the young woman with the determined blue eyes she had seen before in Telairun Riod. Who was she? Amice and Bear had mentioned the others, usually in acid tones, but never another. She wore a blue-fringed shawl. They all wore their shawls. Their dresses changed color and cut from moment to moment, but the shawls never flickered. The Aes Sedai's eyes focused immediately on Egwene. The Wise Ones might as well not have existed. "Egwene Alvear," Shiriam said formally, "you are summoned before the Hall of the Tower." Her tilted green eyes shone with some suppressed emotion. Egwene's stomach sank. They knew she had been masquerading as a full sister. "Ask not why you are summoned," Carlinia said right behind Shiriam, her icy voice making the formality even harder. "It is yours to answer, not to question." For some reason, she had cut her dark hair short. That was the sort of unimportant detail that seemed to loom large in Egwene's mind. She certainly did not want to think about what this all meant. The ceremonious phrases rolled on in a stately rhythm. Amice and Bear adjusted their shawls and frowned, their irritation beginning to turn to concern. "Delay not in your coming." Egwene had always thought Anaya kindly, but the bluff-faced woman sounded as firm as Carlinia, and not all that much warmer in her formality. "It is yours to obey in haste." The three spoke in unison. "It is well to fear the summons of the hall, It is well to obey in haste and humility, unasking. You are summoned to kneel before the hall of the tower and accept their judgment." Egwene controlled her breathing, at least enough that she managed not to pant. What was the penalty for what she had done? Not light, she suspected. Not if all this ceremony went with it. They were all staring at her. She tried to read something on those Aes Sedai faces. Six showed only ageless serenity, with maybe a hint of intensity in the eyes. The young blue had the cool calmness of one who had been Aes Sedai for years, but she could not hide a slight, satisfied smile. They seemed to be waiting for something. "I will come as soon as I can," she said. Maybe her stomach was down in her ankles, but she could match them with her voice. No cowardice. She would be Aes Sedai, if they let her, after this. "I don't know how quickly, though. It's a long way, and I do not know exactly where Salidar is, just somewhere along the River Eldar." Shiriam exchanged glances with the others. Her dress went from pale blue silk to dark gray with divided skirts. "We are sure there is a way to make the journey quickly, if the wise ones will help. Swan is sure it will require no more than a day or two if you enter Tel Iron Riad physically." "No," Bear snapped. At the same instant, Amis said, "We will not teach her such a thing. It was used for evil, it is evil, and whoever does it loses part of themselves." "You cannot be sure of this," Bayonin said patiently, "since it seems none of you have ever done it. But if you know of it, you must have some notion of how it is done. We may be able to work out what you do not know." Patience was exactly the wrong tone. Ami settled her shawl and stood up even straighter than usual. Bear planted fists on hips with a glare that showed teeth. In a moment there was going to be one of those eruptions the wise ones had hinted at. They were going to teach these Aes Sedai a few lessons about what could be done in Tel Iron Riad, by way of showing them how little they knew. The Aes Sedai faced them quite calmly, full of confidence. Their shawls held steady, but their dresses flickered almost as fast as Egwene's heartbeat. Only the young blue's garb had any semblance of holding, changing just once during that long silence. She had to stop it. She had to go to Salidar, and it certainly would help nothing if she came as witness to the humiliation of these Aes Sedai. "I know how. I think I do. I'm willing to try." If it did not work, she could always ride. "But I still have to know where, better than I do now, anyway." Amis and Bear turned their attention from the Aes Sedai to her. Not even Carlinia could have equaled those cold stares, or Morvryn. Egwene's heart sank after her stomach. Shiriam immediately began giving directions, so many miles west of this village, so many leagues south of that, but the young blue cleared her throat and said, "This may be more help." The voice sounded familiar, but Egwene could not connect it to the face. Perhaps she had little better control of her clothing than the others. Soft green silk became deep blue as she spoke. A high embroidered neck became a lace ruff in the Tyran style, a cap of pearls appearing on her head. But she did know something of Tel Iron Riad. Suddenly a large map hung in the air to one side, with a glowing red dot at one end labeled Kyrian in large letters, and another as Salidar at the other. The map began to expand and change. Suddenly the mountains were not just lines, but raised up. The forests took on shades of green and brown. The rivers glittered like blue water in sunlight. It grew until it made a wall hiding the entire side of the heart. It was like looking down on the world. Even the wise ones were impressed enough to ignore their disapproval, at least until the woman's Tyran gown turned to yellow silk with a silver-embroidered neckline. The young woman was not interested in them, though. For some reason she stared challengingly at the other Aes Sedai. "That is splendid, Swan," Shiriam said after a moment. Egwene blinked. "Swan? It must be a woman of the same name." This younger Swan gave a self-satisfied sniff and a sharp nod very reminiscent of Swan Sanche, but that was impossible. You're just trying to put it off, she told herself firmly. It's certainly enough for me to find Salidar, whether or not I can... She glanced at Amis and Bear, so full of silent disapproval they could have been carved of winter stone. Whether or not I can come here in the flesh. One way or another, I promise I will be in Salidar as soon as I can. The map vanished. Light! What are they going to do to me? Her mouth half-formed the question, and Carlinia cut her off sharply, deep in the ceremony again and even harder than before. Ask not why you are summoned. It is yours to answer, not to question. Delay not in your coming, Anaya said. It is yours to obey in haste. The Aes Sedai exchanged glances and vanished so quickly, she half wondered whether they thought she would ask anyway. That left her alone with Amis and Bear, but when she turned to them, uncertain whether to begin with an explanation or an apology or just a plea for understanding, they vanished too, leaving her there alone, surrounded by the redstone columns, with Kalandor glittering beside her. There were no excuses in Je'ito. Exhaling sadly, she stepped out of Telairun Riod back to her sleeping body. She woke immediately. Waking when you wished was as much a part of a dreamwalker's training as going to sleep when you wished, and she had promised to go as quickly as she could. Channeling, she lit the lamps, all of them. She would need light. She made an effort to be brisk as she knelt beside one of the small chests that stood against the walls of the tent and began digging out clothes she had not worn since going to the waste. A part of her life was over, but she would not cry over the loss. She would not.
As soon as Egwene disappeared, Rand stepped out from among the columns. He came here sometimes to look at Kalandor. The first visit had been after Asmodian taught him to invert his weaves. Then he had changed the traps laid around the Sangreal, so only he could see them. If the prophecies could be believed, whoever drew it out would follow after him. He was not sure how much he did believe any longer, but there was no sense taking chances. Luce Theron rumbled somewhere in the back of his head. He always did when Rand came close to Kalandor. But tonight the gleaming crystal sword interested Rand not at all. He stared at where the huge map had hung. Not really a map, there at the end, but something more. What was this place? Was it simple chance that drew him here tonight instead of yesterday or tomorrow? One of his Tavirin tugs on the pattern? No matter. Egwene had accepted that summons meekly, and that she would never do if it came from the Tower and Elida. This Salidar was where her mysterious friends were hiding, where Elaine was. They had handed themselves to him. Laughing, he opened a gateway to the reflection of the palace in Camelon.
Chapter 33. Courage to Strengthen. Kneeling in just her shift, Egwene frowned at the dark green silk riding dress she had worn into the waist, which seemed a very long time ago. There was so much to do. She had given some time to writing a hasty note and rousing Coinda from her blankets with instructions to leave it at the Longman in the morning. It said little beyond the fact that she had to go away. She did not know much more, but she could not just disappear without telling Gawain. A few of the phrases made her blush to remember. Saying she loved him was one thing, but actually asking him to wait. Yet she had taken care of him as far as was possible. Now she had to ready herself, and she hardly knew for what. The tent flap was thrown back, and Amis entered, then Bear and Cerulea. They stood in a line looking down at her, three faces stern with disapproval. It was very hard not to clutch the dress to her breast. In her shift she felt very much at a disadvantage. In armor she would have been at a disadvantage, a matter of knowing she was in the wrong. She was surprised it had taken them so long to come. She took a deep breath. If you've come to punish me, I don't have time for carrying water or digging holes or any of it. I am sorry, but I said I would come as soon as I can, and I think they mean to count minutes. Amice's pale eyebrows rose in surprise, and a puzzled look passed between Cyrilia and Bear. How should we punish you? Amice asked. You stopped being a pupil the moment your sisters summoned you. You must go to them as Aes Sedai. Egwene covered a wince by examining the riding dress again. It had gathered remarkably few wrinkles for having been rolled up in a chest all these months. She made herself face them again. I know you're angry with me, and you have cause.
Angry? Cyrilia said.
We are not angry. I thought you knew us better. It was true she did not sound angry, yet censure still painted all their faces, including hers. Egwene stared from one to the other, especially Amice and Bear. But you told me how wrong you think what I'm going to do is. You said I must not even think about it. I said I wouldn't, and then I went ahead and worked out how to do it. Startlingly, a smile bloomed on Cyrilia's leathery face. Her multitude of bracelets clattered as she shifted her shawl in a satisfied manner. You see? I told you she would understand. She could be Aiel. Some of the tightness faded from Amice, a little more from Bear, and Egwene understood. They were not angry that she meant to try entering Telairun Riod in the flesh. That was wrong in their eyes, but you had to do what you felt you had to do. And even if this worked, it incurred no obligation except to herself. Not angry at all, really. Not yet. What dug at them was her lie. Her stomach fluttered. The lie she had admitted. Maybe her smallest lie. Another deep breath was required to prime her throat for the words. I lied about other things, too. I entered Telairun Riod alone after I promised I would not. Amice's face darkened again. Cyrilia, not a dreamwalker, only shook her head ruefully. I promised to obey as a pupil, but when you said the world of dreams was too dangerous after I was injured, I went anyway. Bear folded her arms, expressionless. Cyrilia muttered something about foolish girls, but it hardly sounded heated. A third long breath. This would be the hardest to say. Her middle was not fluttering anymore. It danced so hard she was surprised she was not shaking. The worst of all is, I am not Aes Sedai. I'm only accepted. You might call me an apprentice. I will not be raised to Aes Sedai for years, if I ever am now. Cyrilia's head came up at that, thin lips compressed in a hard line, but still none of them said anything. It was up to Egwene to make matters right. They could never be exactly as before, but... You've admitted everything, a small voice whispered. Now you'd better get on with finding out how fast you can reach Salidar. You can still be raised Aes Sedai one day, but not if you make them madder than they already are. Egwene lowered her eyes and stared at the colorful layered carpets, her mouth twisting with scorn. Scorn for that small voice, and shame that it could speak in her head, that she could think it. She was going away, but before she did, she had to put matters right. It was possible, under Ji'i To. You did what you had to do, then paid the cost. Long months ago in the waste, Avienda had showed her how a lie was paid for. Gathering every scrap of courage she could find, hoping it was enough, Egwene put the silk dress aside and stood. Strangely, beginning seemed to make going on easier. She still had to look up to meet their eyes, but she did it proudly, head high, and she did not have to force the words at all. I have to. Her stomach was not fluttering any longer. I ask the favor that you will help me meet my to. Salidar was going to have to wait.
Leaning on his elbow, Matt examined the game of snakes and foxes laid out on the tent floor. Occasionally a drop of sweat fell from his chin, just missing the board. It was not a board at all, really. Just a piece of red cloth with the web of lines drawn in black ink and arrows showing which lines allowed movement only one way and which both. 10 pale wooden discs, each with an inked triangle, were the foxes, 10 with a wavy line, the snakes. Two lamps set to either side gave more than enough light.
"We'll win this time, Matt," Alver said excitedly. "I know we will."
"Maybe," Matt said. Their two blackstained discs were nearly to the circle in the middle of the board, but the next roll of the dice would be for the snakes and foxes. Most of the time, you did not make it as far as the outer edge. "Roll the dice." He never touched the dice cup himself since the day he had given it to the boy. If they were going to play the game, it might as well be without his luck taking a hand. With a grin, Alvar rattled the leather cup and spilled out the wooden dice his father had made. He groaned as he counted the pips. This time, three dice showed faces marked with a triangle, the other three wavy lines. On their turn, you had to move the snakes and foxes toward your own pieces by the shortest path, and if one landed on the point you occupied, a snake touched Alvar, a fox Matt, and Matt could see if the rest of the pips had been played, two more snakes would have reached him. Only a child's game, and one you would not win so long as you followed the rules. Soon Alvar would be old enough to realize that, and like other children, stop playing. Only a child's game, but Matt did not like the fox getting him, and even less the snakes. It brought back bad memories, even if one had nothing to do with the other. "Well," Alvar muttered, "we almost won. Another game, Matt?" Not waiting for an answer, he made the sign that opened the game, a triangle, and then a wavy line through it, then chanted the words, "Courage to strengthen, fire to blind, music to dazzle, iron to bind."
"Matt, why do we say that? There is no fire, no music, and no iron."
"I don't know." The line tickled something in the back of his head, but he could not bring it up. The old memories from the Tirangrial might as well have been chosen at random. They probably had been. And there were all those gaps in his own, all those fuzzy places. The boy was always asking questions he did not know the answer to, usually beginning with why. Darid ducked in out of the night and gave a start of surprise. Face shining with sweat, he still had his coat on, if hanging undone. His newest scar made a pink furrow across the white lines crisscrossing his face. "I think it's past your bedtime, Alvar," Matt said, pushing himself up. His wounds gave a few tinges, but only a few. They were healing just fine. "Put the board up." He stepped close to Darid and lowered his voice to a whisper. "If you ever tell about this, I'll cut your throat." "Why?" Darid asked dryly. "You are turning into a wonderful father. He shows a remarkable resemblance to you." He seemed to be struggling with a grin, but a moment later it was gone. "The Lord Dragon is coming into camp," he said, as serious as death. Thoughts of punching Darid in the nose vanished. Matt pushed the tent flap aside and ducked into the night in his shirt sleeves. Six of Darid's men, in a circle around the tent, stiffened when he appeared. Crossbowmen. Pikes certainly would not be much good for guards. It was night, but not dark in the camp. The bright glow of a waxing three-quarter moon in a cloudless sky was washed out by the light of fires spaced among the rows of tents and men sleeping on the ground. Sentries stood every 20 paces, all the way to the log palisade. Not the way Matt would have preferred it, but if an attack could pop out of the air. The land lay nearly flat here, so he had a clear view of Rand striding toward him. Not alone. Two veiled Aiel moved on their toes, heads swiveling every time one of the band rolled over in his sleep, or a sentry shifted his feet to watch them. That Aiel woman Avienda was with him as well, a bundle across her back, stalking along as if she would go for the throat of anyone who got in her way. Matt did not understand why Rand kept her around. "Aiel women are nothing but trouble," he thought bleakly, "and I've never seen a woman more set to give trouble than that one."
"Is that really the dragon reborn?" Alvar asked breathlessly.
Clutching the rolled-up game to his chest, he was almost bouncing. "It is," Matt told him. "Now get off to bed. This is no place for boys." Alvar went, muttering reproachfully, but only as far as the next tent. Out of the corner of his eye, Matt saw the boy dart out of sight. His face reappeared, peering around the corner. Matt left him alone, though after getting a good look at Rand's face, he wondered whether this was any place for grown men, let alone a boy. That face could have been used to hammer down a wall, but some emotion struggled to break through, excitement or maybe eagerness. Rand's eyes held a fevered light. He had a wide piece of rolled parchment in one hand, while the other stroked his sword hilt unconsciously. The dragon belt buckle glittered in the firelight. Sometimes the head of one of the dragons peeking out from his coat sleeves did, too. When he reached Matt, he wasted no time with greetings.
I need to talk to you. Alone. I need you to do something.
The night was a black oven, and Rand wore a gold-embroidered green coat with a high collar, but he was not sweating a drop. Dered Telmanis, an Elysian, stood a few paces away in various states of undress, watching. Matt motioned them to wait, then nodded toward his tent. Following Rand in, he fingered the silver fox head through his shirt. He had nothing to worry about, at least. He hoped he did not. Rand had said alone, but apparently Avienda did not think that applied to her. She stayed a firm 2 paces from him, no more and no less. Mostly she watched Rand with an unreadable face, but now and then she glanced at Matt, frowning and eyeing him up and down. Rand paid her no attention, and for all his seeming haste before, he showed none now. He looked around the tent, though Matt wondered uneasily whether he was seeing it. There was not much to see. Alvar had set the lamps back on the small folding table. The chair folded too, and so did the washstand and the cot. All were black lacquered with lines of gilt. If a man had coin, he might as well spend it on something. The slits the Aiel had made in the tent had been mended neatly, but they still showed. The silence dug at Matt.
What is this, Rand? I hope you haven't decided to change the plan at this late date.
No answer, only a look as if Rand had just remembered he was there. It made Matt nervous. Whatever Dered and the rest of the band thought, he worked hard at keeping clear of battles. Sometimes, though, being Tavirin worked against his luck. That was the way he saw it. He believed Rand had something to do with that. He was more strongly Tavirin, strong enough that at times Matt almost felt a pulling. When Rand put his finger in, Matt would not be surprised to find himself in the middle of a battle if he was asleep in a barn. A few more days and I'll be in Tyr. The ferries will take the band across the river, and a few days beyond that, we'll see us with Wyramon. It's too bloody late to go meddling.
I want you to bring Elaine to Camelin, Rand broke in. I want you to see her safe to Camelin, whatever happens. Don't leave her side until she's on the Lion Throne.
Avienda cleared her throat.
Yes, Rand said.
For some reason, his voice went as cold and hard as his face. But then, did he need reasons if he was going mad?
Avienda is going with you. I think it's best.
You think it's best? She said indignantly. If I had not wakened when I did, I would never have known you had found her. You did not send me anywhere, Randall Thor. I must speak with Elaine for my own reasons.
I am very glad you found Elaine, Matt said carefully. If he was Rand, he would leave the woman wherever she was. Light Avienda would be better. At least Aiel women did not walk around with their noses in the air or think you should jump just because they said so. Of course, some of their games were on the rough side, and they did have the habit of trying to kill you now and again.
I just don't understand why you need me. Jump through one of your gateways, give her a kiss, scoop her up, and jump back.
Avienda fastened an outraged stare on him. You would have thought he had advised kissing her. Rand unrolled the large parchment on the table, using the lamps to hold down the ends.
This is where she is.
It was a map, a stretch of the river Eldar, and maybe 50 miles or so to either side. An arrow had been drawn in blue ink, pointing into forest. Saladar was printed beside the arrow. Rand tapped near the eastern edge of the map. That was wooded, too. Most of it was. There is a large clearing here. You can see the nearest village is nearly 20 miles north. I'll put a gateway through to the clearing for you and the band. Matt managed to turn a wince into a grin.
Look, if it has to be me,
Why not just me? Make your gateway to this Saladar. I toss her on a horse and...
And what? Was Rand going to make a gateway from Saladar to Camelin as well? It was a long ride from the Eldar to Camelin. A very long way, with only a snooty noblewoman and an Aiel for company.
The band, Matt, Rand snapped. You and the whole band.
He drew a long, shuddering breath, and his tone became milder. His face did not lose its rigidity, though, and his eyes were still feverish. Rand could almost believe he was sick, or in pain.
There are Aes Sedai in Saladar, Matt. I don't know how many. Hundreds, I've heard. But I won't be surprised if it is closer to 50. The way they go on about the tower whole and pure, I doubt you'll see more. I mean to put you out 2 or 3 days away so they can learn you're coming. No point in startling them. They might think you were a White Cloak attack. They're rebels against Elida, and probably frightened enough that you won't have to do more than loom a little and say Elaine has to be crowned in Camelin to make them let her go. If you think they can be trusted, offer your protection. And mine. They're supposed to be on my side, and they might be glad of even my protection by now. Then you escort Elaine, and as many of the Aes Sedai as want to come, straight across Altara and Murindi to Camelin. Show my banners, announce what you're doing, and I don't think the Altarans or Mirandians will give much trouble, not as long as you keep moving. If you find any dragon swan along the way, gather them in as well. Most will probably turn to bandits if I don't tie a rope to them soon. I've heard a rumor or two already, but you will draw them, flying my banners. His sudden grin showed teeth, but never touched those hot eyes. How many birds with one stone, Matt? You ride through Altara and Murindi with 6,000 men and draw the dragon sworn out after you, and you may hand me both countries. There was so much in that to set Matt's teeth on edge that he no longer cared whether Rand had 10 sore teeth and both boots full of cockleburrs. Make Aes Sedai think he meant to attack them? Indeed not. And he was supposed to intimidate 50 of them? Aes Sedai did not frighten him, maybe not even 5 or 6 together. But 50? He touched the fox head through his shirt again before he realized it. He might just find out how lucky he really was. As for riding across Altara and Murindi, he could see it now. Every noble whose lands he crossed would swell up like a strutting rooster and try to peck him the moment his back was turned. If that Taviran madness came into it, he would probably find some lord or lady gathering an army right in front of him. He made one more try. Rand, don't you think this might draw Samael's eyes north? You want him looking east. That is why I'm here, remember? To make him look this way. Rand shook his head emphatically. All he'll see is a guard of honor escorting the Queen of Andor to Camelin. And that's if he learns of it before you reach Camelin. How quickly can you be ready? Matt opened his mouth, then gave it up. He was not going to budge the man. 2 hours. The band could be booted and in their saddles faster, but he was in no hurry, and the last thing he wanted was the band thinking they were moving on the attack. Good. I need an hour or so myself. For what, he did not say. Stay close to Elaine, Matt. Keep her safe. I mean, there's no point to this if she doesn't reach Camelin alive for her coronation. Did Rand think he did not know about him and Elaine, canoodling in every corner of the stone the last time they were together? I'll treat her like my own sister. His sisters had done their best to make his life miserable. Well, he expected the same from Elaine, just in a different way. Maybe Avienda would be a little better. She won't get out of my sight until I plunk her down in the royal palace. And if she tries Mistress Snoodon with me too often, I'll bloody well kick her. Rand nodded. That reminds me. Bertawin is in Camelin, with Varen and Alana. And some more Two Rivers girls. They're on their way to train for Aes Sedai. I'm not sure where they will do it. I am certainly not letting them go to the tower the way things are. Maybe the Aes Sedai you bring back will take care of it. Matt gaped. His sister? Aes Sedai, Bode, who used to run tell their mother every time he did anything that was fun.
Another thing, Rand went on. Egwene may be in Salidar before you. I think somehow they found out she's been calling herself Aes Sedai. Do what you can to get her out of it. Tell her I will get her back to the Wise Ones as soon as I can. She'll probably be more than ready to go with you. Maybe not, though. You know how stubborn she's always been. The main thing is Elaine. Remember, don't leave her side till she reaches Camelin.
I promise, Matt muttered. How under the lie could Egwene be somewhere on the Eldar? He was sure she had been in Kyrian when he left Mehrone. Unless she had worked out Rand's trick with the gateways, in which case she could jump back any time she wished, or jump to Camelin and make a gateway for him and the band at the same time.
Don't worry about Egwene either. I'll drag her out of whatever trouble she's in, no matter how muley she behaves.
It would not be the first time he had pulled her chestnuts off the hearth before they burned. Very likely he would get no thanks for it this time either.
Bode was going to be Aes Sedai? Blood and bloody ashes.
Good, Rand said. Good. But he was staring intently at the map. He jerked his eyes away, and for an instant, Matt thought he intended to say something to Avienda. Instead, he turned away from her roughly.
Tom Marilyn should be with Elaine.
Rand produced a letter from his pocket, folded and sealed.
See that he gets this.
Shoving the letter into Matt's hands, he hurriedly left the tent.
Avienda took a step after him, half raising a hand, lips parted to speak. Just as suddenly, her mouth snapped shut, and she buried her hands in her skirts and squeezed her eyes shut.
So the wind came that way, did it? And she wants to talk to Elaine. How did Rand ever get himself in this pickle? Rand was always the one who knew how to handle women, Rand and Perrin.
Still, it was no concern of his. He turned the letter over in his hands. Tom's name was written in a feminine hand. The seal was one he did not recognize, a spreading tree topped by a crown. What noblewoman would be writing to a leathery old man like Tom? Not his concern either. Tossing the letter on the table, he picked up his pipe and pouch.
Alvar, he said, stuffing the bowl with tabak. Ask Talmanis, Nalisian, and Darid to come to me.
There was a squeak just outside the door flap, then,
Yes, Matt!
And the sound of scurrying feet. Avienda looked at him, folding her arms with a firm expression. He forestalled her.
So long as you travel with the band, you are under my command. I want no trouble, and I expect you to see there isn't any.
Should she start anything, he would deliver her to Elaine, tied in a pack saddle, if it took 10 men to put her there.
I know how to follow, battle leader.
She punctuated that with a sharp sniff. But you should know that not all women are wetlander soft. If you try putting a woman on a horse when she does not want to go, she may put a knife in your ribs.
Matt nearly dropped the pipe.
He knew Aes Sedai could not read minds. If they could, his hide would have been hanging on a wall in the White Tower long since. But maybe Aiel Wise Ones?
Of course not. It's just one of those tricks women pull.
He could figure out how she did it if he put his mind to it. He just did not care to put his mind to it. Clearing his throat, he stuck the unlit pipe between his teeth and bent to study the map. The band could probably cover the distance from the clearing to Salidar in a day if he pushed, even in that wooded terrain, but he intended to take 2 or even 3, give the Aes Sedai plenty of warning. He did not want them any more frightened than they already were. A frightened Aes Sedai was almost a contradiction. Even wearing the medallion, he was not eager to learn what a frightened Aes Sedai might do. He felt Avienda's eyes in the back of his neck, heard a rasping sound. Sitting cross-legged against the tent wall, she was drawing her belt knife along a honing stone and watching him. When Nalisian entered with Darid and Talmanis, he greeted them with,
We are going to tickle some Aes Sedai under the chin, rescue a mule, and put a snip-nosed girl on the lion throne.
Oh, yes, that's Avienda. Don't look at her crosswise, or she'll try to cut your throat, and probably slit her own by mistake.
The woman laughed as if he had made the funniest joke in the world. She did not stop sharpening her knife, though.
For a moment, Egwene could not understand why the pain had stopped increasing. Then she pushed herself up from the carpets of her tent and stood, sobbing so hard she quivered. She wanted very much to blow her nose. She did not know how long she'd been crying that hard. She only knew she felt on fire from the top of her hips to the backs of her knees. Standing still was a problem she barely mastered. The shift she had thought of as scant protection had been discarded some time back. Tears rolled down her face, and she stood there and bawled. Cerulea and Amis and Bear regarded her soberly, and they were not the only ones, though most of the rest were sitting about on cushions or stretched out, talking and enjoying tea served by a slender Geishine. A woman, thank the light. They were all women, wise ones and apprentices, women Egwene had told she was Aes Sedai. She was grateful that just letting them think she was did not count. She could not have survived that. It was the telling, the spoken lie, but there had been surprises. Kosain, a lean, yellow-haired, spine-ridged Miagoma, had said gruffly that Egwene had no toe toward her, but she would stay for the tea, and so had Astaire. Aeron, on the other hand, seemed to want to cut her in two, and Surunda. Trying to blink away the haze of tears, Egwene glanced toward Surunda. She was sitting with three wise ones, chatting and occasionally looking in Egwene's direction. Surunda had been absolutely merciless. Not that any of them had gone easy. The belt Egwene had found in one of her chests was thin and supple, but twice as wide as her hand, and these women all had strong arms. A half dozen or so strokes from each added up. Egwene had never felt so ashamed in her life. Not that she was naked and red-faced and weeping like a baby. Well, the weeping was part. Not even that they had all watched her strapped when not taking their own turns. What shamed her was that she had taken it so badly. An Aiel child would have been more stoic. Well, a child would never have had to face it, but the principle was the simple truth.
"Is it over?"
Was that thick, unsteady voice really hers? How these women would laugh if they knew how carefully she had gathered her courage. "Only you know the worth of your honor," Amis said flatly. She held the belt dangling at her side, using the wide buckle as a handle. The murmur of conversation had ceased. Egwene drew a long, shaking breath through her sobs. All she had to do was say it was done, and it was. She could have said enough after one blow from each woman. She could... Wincing, she knelt and stretched herself out on the carpets. Her hands went beneath Bear's skirts to grasp the woman's bony ankles through her soft boots. This time she would hold on to her courage. This time she would not cry out. This time she would not kick or thrash about or... The belt had not hit her yet. Raising her head, she blinked her eyes clear to glare at them.
"What are you waiting for?"
Her voice still shook, but there was more than a note of anger, too. "Making her wait on top of everything else? I have a journey to make tonight in case you've forgotten. Get on with it." Amis tossed the belt down beside Egwene's head. "This woman has no toe toward me." "This woman has no toe toward me." That was Bear's thin voice. "This woman has no toe toward me," Cerulea said forcefully. Bending, she smoothed damp hair from Egwene's face. "I knew you were Aiel in your heart. Do not be overproud now, girl. You have met your toe. Get up before we think you are boasting." Then they were helping her to her feet, hugging her and wiping away her tears, holding a handkerchief for her to finally blow her nose. The other women gathered around, each announcing that this woman had no toe toward her, before adding her own hugs and smiles. It was the smiles that were the biggest shock. Surunda beamed at her as brightly as ever. But of course, toe did not exist once it was met. Whatever earned it might as well never have happened. A bit of Egwene that was not wrapped up in Je'ito thought that maybe what she had said at the end helped, too, as well as getting back down in the first place. Perhaps she had not faced it with the indifference of an Aiel in the beginning, but at the end Cerulea was right. She had been Aiel in her heart. She thought a part of her heart always would be Aiel. The wise ones and apprentices left slowly. Apparently they should remain the rest of the night or longer, all laughing and talking with Egwene, but that was just custom, not Jito. And with Cerulea's help she managed to convince them that she just did not have the time. At last it was only her, Cerulea, and the two dreamwalkers. All the hugs and smiles had slowed her tears to a trickle, and if her lips still trembled no matter what she did, she could still smile. In truth, she wanted to cry again, if for a different reason. Partly for a different reason. She was on fire. "I'm going to miss all of you so much." "Nonsense," Cerulea snorted for emphasis. "If you have luck, they will tell you you can never be Aes Sedai now. Then you can return to us. You will be my apprentice. In 3 or 4 years you will have your own hold. I even know the husband for you, my great daughter Amarin's youngest great son Tarik. He will be a clan chief one day, I think, so you must watch for a sister wife to be his roof mistress." "Thank you," Egwene laughed. It seemed she had something to fall back on if the hall in Salidar did send her away. "And Amis and I will meet you in Tel Iron Riod," Bear said, "and tell you what we know of events here and with Randall Thor. You will go your own way in the world of dreams now, but if you wish it, I will still teach you." "I do wish it." If the hall let her anywhere near Tel Iron Riod. But then they could not keep her out. Whatever they did, they could not do that. "Please keep a close eye on Rand and the Aes Sedai. I don't know what he is playing, but I'm sure it is more dangerous than he thinks." Amis said nothing about more teaching, of course. She had given her word on a course of action, and even meeting To did not erase that. Instead, she said, "I know Ruark will regret not being here tonight. He has gone north to look at the Shido for himself. Do not be afraid your To toward him must go unmet. He will give you the opportunity when you meet once more." Egwene gaped, and covered by blowing her nose for what seemed the 10th time. She had forgotten all about Ruark. Of course, nothing said she had to pay her obligation to him in the same way. Maybe her heart was at least partly Aiel, but for a moment her mind sought frantically for another method. There had to be one, and she would have plenty of time to find it before seeing him again. "I will be very grateful," she said faintly. And there was Milane, too, and Avienda. Light! She had thought she was done with it. Her feet kept shifting no matter how hard she tried to hold still. There had to be another way. Bear opened her mouth, but Cerulea cut her off. "We must let her clothe herself. She has a journey to begin." Bear's thin neck stiffened, and Amis's mouth turned down. Clearly neither liked what Egwene was going to try any more than before. Maybe they meant to stay and try talking her out of it, but Cerulea began muttering only half under her breath about fools who tried to stop a woman from doing what she thought she had to do. The younger pair straightened their shawls. Bear had to be 70 or 80, but she certainly still was younger than Cerulea, gave Egwene a farewell hug, and left with murmurs of, "May you always find water and shade." Cerulea waited only a moment longer. "Think on Tarik. I should have asked him to the sweat tent so you could see him. Until you can, remember this. We are always more afraid than we wish to be, but we can always be braver than we expect. Hold on to your heart, and the Aes Sedai cannot harm what is really you, your heart. They are not nearly so far above us as we believed. May you always find water and shade, Egwene, and always remember your heart." Alone, Egwene merely stood for a time, staring at nothing and thinking. Her heart. Perhaps she did have more courage than she thought. She had done what she had to here. She had been Aiel. In Salidar, she was going to need that. Aes Sedai methods differed from the wise ones in some respects, but they would not go easy if they knew she had called herself Aes Sedai. If they knew. She could not imagine why else they would summon her so coldly, but Aiel did not surrender before battle was joined. With a start, she came to herself. If I'm not going to surrender before fighting, she thought wryly, I might as well get on to the battle. Chapter 34 Journey to Salidar. Egwene washed her face. Twice. Then she found her saddlebags and filled them. Her ivory comb and brush and mirror went in, and her sewing box, a small, finely gilded casket that likely had held some lady's jewels once, plus a white cake of rose-perfumed soap and clean stockings and shifts and handkerchiefs and a host of things, until the leather sides bulged, and she could hardly buckle the flaps down. Several dresses and cloaks, an Aiel shawl remained to make a bundle, which she tied neatly with a cord. That done, she looked around for anything else she might want to take. It was all hers. Even the tent had been given to her, but that was certainly too bulky, as were the carpets and cushions. Her crystal washbasin was beautiful and far too heavy. The same for the chests, though several had beautiful work on the strapping and lovely carving. Only then, thinking about the chests of all things, did she realize she was trying to put off the hardest part of getting ready. Courage, she said dryly. Heart of an Aiel. It turned out to be quite possible to put on stockings without sitting down, so long as you did not mind hopping around. Stout shoes followed, good if she had to walk far, and a silk shift, white and soft. Then the dark green riding dress with its narrow divided skirts. Unfortunately, that fit quite snugly over the hips, enough to remind her unnecessarily that she would not enjoy sitting for a while. There was no point going outside. Bear and Amis were probably in their own tents, but she had no intention of risking the chance one of them might see her do this. It would be like slapping them. If it worked, that was. If not, she had a very long ride ahead of her. Nervously rubbing her fingers over her palms, she embraced Saidar, letting it fill her, and shifted her feet. Saidar made you more aware of everything, including your own body, which she would just as soon have missed right then. Trying something new, something no one had ever tried before that she knew, should have been done slowly and carefully, but for once she wanted to be rid of the source. She channeled briskly, flows of spirit, woven just so. The air shimmered in the middle of the tent along her weave, cloaking the other side in mistiness. If she was right, she had just created a place where the interior of her tent was so similar to its reflection in Tel Aran Riod that there was no difference at all right there. One was the other. But there was only one way to be sure. Tossing the saddlebags over her shoulder, she took the bundle under one arm and stepped through the weave, then let go of Saidar. She was in Tel Aran Riod. All it took to tell her was that the lamps that had been lit were no longer burning, yet there was a sort of light. Things moved slightly between one glance and the next, the washbasin, a chest. She was in Tel Aran Riod in the flesh. It felt no different than when she came in a dream. She ducked outside. A three-quarter moon shone down on tents where no fire burned and no one moved, on a Kyrian that seemed oddly distant and clouded in shadow. All that remained was the problem of actually getting to Salidar. She had thought about that. A great deal depended on whether she had as much control in the flesh as when she was part of the world of dreams. Fixing in her mind what she would find, she walked around the tent and smiled. There stood Bella, the short, shaggy mare she had ridden out of the Two Rivers a lifetime ago. Only a dream, Bella, but the stout mare tossed her nose and whickered at sight of her. Egwene dropped her burdens and flung her arms around the horse's head. "I'm glad to see you again, too," she whispered. That dark, liquid eye looking at her was Bella's, reflection or no. Bella wore the high-cantled saddle she had imagined, too. Comfortable for long travel normally, but not soft. Egwene eyed the thing askance, wondering how it would look padded. Then she had a thought. You could change anything in Tel Aran Riod if you knew how, even yourself. If she had enough control to make Bella while in the flesh, she concentrated on herself. With a smile, she fastened the saddlebags and bundle behind the saddle and climbed up herself, settling quite comfortably. It isn't cheating, she told the mare. They would not expect me to ride all the way to Salidar like that. Well, come to think of it, maybe they would. Even so, Aiel Heart or no Aiel Heart, there were limits. Turning Bella, she healed the mare's ribs gently. I need to be as quick as I can, so you will need to run like the wind. Before she had time to chuckle at the image that came to mind of plump Bella running like the wind, the mare was doing so. The landscape blurred, streaking by. For a moment, Egwene clung to the pommel of the saddle, her mouth hanging open. It was as if Bella's every trotting step carried them miles. With the first, she had an instant to realize they were on the riverbank below the city, with ships floating out on the dark waters amid streaks of moonlight. And even as she tried to jerk at the reins, to stop Bella running headlong into the river, another step took them into thicketed hills. Egwene threw back her head and laughed. This was marvelous. Except for the blurring, there was little real sensation of speed. Her hair hardly had time to stream back in the wind of that rush before it was gone, only to come again a moment later. Bella's gait felt the same plodding trot she recalled, but the sudden leap of everything around her was exhilarating. One moment a village street, moon dark and silent, the next a country road winding through hills, the next a meadow with hay standing almost to Bella's shoulders. Egwene only paused now and again to orient herself. No trouble at all with that marvelous map in her head, the one the woman with Swan's name had made, and otherwise let Bella trot. Villages and towns appeared and vanished in a blur. Great cities, one she thought sure was Camelin, walls silvery white in the night, and once in forested hills, the head and shoulders of a huge statue rearing out of the earth, a remnant of some land lost in history, appearing so suddenly at Bella's side with a withered grimace that Egwene nearly screamed, only it was gone before she could. The moon did not move at all between leaps, and hardly any as they sped along. A day or two to reach Salidar? That was what Shiriam had said. The wise ones were right. Everyone had believed for so long that Aes Sedai knew everything that Aes Sedai believed it too. She was going to prove them wrong tonight. But it was not likely they would take any real notice of her proof. They knew. After a time, when she was sure she was somewhere well into Altara, she began letting Bella make smaller jumps, reining her in more often, even riding normally for a bit, especially if there was a village nearby. Sometimes a night-shrouded inn had a sign that named the village the Morella Inn, or the Ionan Spring Inn, and moonlight added to the odd sense of light in Tel Iron Riod made reading them easy. Bit by bit she became absolutely certain where she was in relation to Salidar, and began to take still smaller leaps, then none at all, only letting Bella trot normally through forest where tall trees had killed most of the undergrowth, and drought most of the rest. Still she was surprised when a considerable village appeared suddenly, silent and dark in the moonlight. It had to be the right place, though. At the edge of the thatch-roofed stone houses she dismounted and took down her belongings. It was late, but people might still be about in the waking world. No need to startle them by popping out of the air. If an Aes Sedai saw that and mistook what she was, she might have no chance to face the hall. "You did run like the wind," she murmured, hugging Bella a last time. "I wish I could take you with me." A useless fancy, of course. What was made in Tel Iron Riod could exist only there. This was not really Bella, after all. Even so, she felt a twinge of regret as she turned her back. She would not stop imagining Bella, let her exist as long as she could, and wove her shimmering curtain of spirit. Head high, she stepped through, ready to face whatever came with her Aiel heart. One step she took and came up short with a sharp, wide-eyed, "Oh!" The changes she had made in Tel Iron Riod existed in the real world no more than Bella did. The flames returned with a rush, and with them it was almost as though Cerulea spoke to her. "If you take what you did to meet your toe, and make it so it might as well never have happened, how have you met toe? Remember your Aiel heart, girl." Yes, she would remember. She was here to do battle whether the Aes Sedai knew it or not, ready to fight for the right to be Aes Sedai. ready to face light. What? There were people in the streets, a few moving between houses where lighted windows made golden pools. Walking a little gingerly, Egwene approached a wiry woman with a white apron and a harried expression. "Excuse me, my name is Egwene Alvear. I am accepted." The woman gave her riding dress a sharp look. "And I've just arrived. Can you direct me to Shiriam Sedai? I need to find her." Very likely Shiriam was asleep already, but if she was, Egwene intended to wake her. She had been told to come as soon as possible, and Shiriam was going to know she was here. "Everyone comes to me," the woman muttered. "Does anybody do anything for themselves? No, they want Nildra to do it. You accepted are the worst of the lot. Well, I don't have all night. Follow me if you're coming. If not, you can find her for yourself." Nildra strode off without so much as a backward glance. Egwene followed silently. If she opened her mouth, she was afraid she would tell the woman what she thought, and that would hardly be the way to start her stay in Celidar, however short it might be. She wished her Aiel heart and her Two Rivers head could get together. The distance was not long, up the hard-packed dirt street a little way and around the corner into another, narrower street. Sounds of laughter came from some of the houses. Nildra stopped at one that was silent, though light shone in the windows of the front room. Pausing just long enough to knock on the door, she went in before there was any answer. Her curtsy was perfectly proper, if quick, and she spoke in a somewhat more respectful tone than before. "Aes Sedai, this girl says her name is Egwene, and she got out no more. They were all there, the seven from the Heart of the Stone, not a one looking ready for bed, though all but the young woman with Swan's name wore robes. From the way their chairs were pulled together, it seemed that Egwene had walked in on a discussion. Shiriam was the first to leap from her chair, waving Nildra out. "Light child, already?" No one paid any mind at all to Nildra's curtsy, or her put-upon sniff on going. "We never expected," Anaya said, taking Egwene's arms with a warm smile. "Not so soon. Welcome, child. Welcome." "Were there any ill effects?" Morvryn demanded. She had not risen, and neither had Carlinia or the young Aes Sedai, but Morvryn leaned forward intently. All the others' robes were silk of various hues, sometimes brocaded or embroidered. Hers was plain brown wool, though it did look soft and finely woven. "Do you feel any changes from the experience? We had precious little to go on. Frankly, I am surprised it worked." "We shall have to see it work to know how well it does." Bayonin paused for a sip of tea, then set cup and saucer down on a rickety-legged side table. The cup and saucer did not match, but then none of the furniture matched, and most looked as lopsided as the small table. "If there are ill effects, she can be healed, and they will be done with." Egwene stepped away from Anaya quickly, setting her belongings beside the door. "No, I'm quite well. Really, I am." She could have hesitated. Anaya might well have healed her without asking. That would have been cheating, though. "She appears healthy enough," Carlinia said coolly. Her hair really was short, dark curls barely covering her ears. It had not been just something she did in Telairun Riod. She wore white, of course. Even the embroidery was white. "We can have one of the yellows check her thoroughly later to be sure if need be." "Let her get her feet on the ground," Mirella said with a laugh. Lush flowers in yellow and red so covered her robe that hardly any green showed. "She's just come 1,000 leagues in a night, in hours." "You've no time to let her find her feet," the young Aes Sedai put in firmly. She truly looked out of place in that gathering, in her yellow dress with the skirt slashed with blue and the deep round neckline blue embroidered. That, and being the only one it was possible to put an age to. "Come morning, the hall will swarm around her. If she's not ready, Romanda will gut her like a fat carp." Egwene gaped. That voice registered more than the words. "You're Swan Sanche. No, it's impossible." Oh, it is possible, all right, Anaya said dryly, giving the young woman a long-suffering look. Swan is Aes Sedai again. Mirella's look was more exasperated than long-suffering. It had to be true. They had said so, but Egwene could hardly credit it, even when Shiriam explained. Nynaeve had healed Stilling? Being stilled was why Swan looked no older than Nynaeve? Swan had always been a leather-faced taskmistress, and leather-hearted as well, not this pretty, creamy-cheeked woman with an almost delicate mouth. Egwene watched Swan while Shiriam talked. Those blue eyes were the same, though. How could she have seen that gaze, strong enough to drive nails, and not known? Well, the face was answer enough there. But Swan had always been strong in the power, too. When a girl first began, it required testing to tell how strong she would be, but not once she had gained that strength. Egwene knew enough now to weigh another woman in moments. Shiriam was clearly the strongest woman in the room aside from Egwene herself, and Mirella next, though it was hard to be certain. The rest all seemed close, except for Swan. She was weakest by a fair margin. This truly is Nynaeve's most remarkable discovery, Mirella said. The Yellows are taking what she has done and making their own marvels, but she began it. Sit down, child. It is too long a story to hear standing. I prefer to stand, thank you. Egwene eyed the straight-backed chair with a wooden seat that Mirella indicated, and barely repressed a shudder. What about Elaine? Is she all right, too? I want to hear all about her and Nynaeve both. Nynaeve's most remarkable discovery? That implied more than one. It seemed she had fallen behind with the wise ones. She was going to have to run hard to catch up. At least she thought now that she would be allowed to. They would hardly have greeted her so warmly if she was going to be sent away in disgrace. She had not curtsied or called anyone Aes Sedai once, more because she had had no chance than for any other reason. Defiance was no way to face Aes Sedai. Yet no one had called her down. Maybe they did not know after all. But then, why? Except for a little trouble she and Nynaeve have with pots at the moment, Shiriam began, but Swan broke in harshly. Why are you all jabbering like brainless girls? It's too late to be afraid of going on. It has begun. You began it. Either you finish, or Romanda will hang the lot of you in the sun to dry right alongside this girl, and Delaina and Fasella and the rest of the hall will be there with her to stretch you out. Shiriam and Mirella turned to face her almost together. All the Aes Sedai did, Morvryn and Carlinia twisting in their chairs. Cold Aes Sedai eyes stared from cold Aes Sedai faces. At first, Swan met those stares with a challenging stare of her own, as Aes Sedai as they, if seemingly much younger. Then her head fell a little, and spots of color entered her cheeks. She rose from the chair, eyes down. I spoke in haste, she muttered softly. Those eyes did not change. Maybe the Aes Sedai failed to notice, but Egwene saw. Yet that was still not like Swan. Egwene also saw that she did not know what was going on here at all. Not just Swan Sanche meek as milk, if she was pushed to it anyway. That least of all. What had they begun? Why would she be hung out to dry if they stopped? The Aes Sedai exchanged looks as unreadable as Aes Sedai could make them. Morvryn was the first to nod. You have been summoned for a very special reason, Egwene, Shiriam said solemnly. Egwene's heart began to beat faster. They did not know about her. They did not. But what? You, Shiriam said, are to be the next Amyrlin seat. Chapter 35 In the Hall of the Sitters. Egwene stared at Shiriam, wondering whether she was supposed to laugh. Maybe in her time with the Aiel she had forgotten what passed for humor among Aes Sedai. Shiriam stared back with that ageless, imperturbable face, tilted green eyes not seeming to blink. Egwene looked at the others. Seven faces with no expression, just an air of waiting. Swan might have been smiling faintly, but the smile could as easily have been the natural curve of her lips. Wavering lamplight made their features suddenly strange and inhuman. Egwene's head felt light, her knees weak. Without thinking, she let herself thump down in the straight-backed chair. She stood right up again, too. That certainly cleared her mind. A little, anyway. "I am not even Aes Sedai," she said breathlessly. That seemed noncommittal enough. It had to be some sort of joke, or something. "That can be gotten around," Shiriam said firmly, jerking the bow of her pale blue sash tighter for emphasis. Bayonin's honey-colored braid swayed as she nodded. "The Ammerlin seat, she is Aes Sedai. The law is quite clear. Several places it is stated, the Ammerlin seat as Aes Sedai. But nowhere is it said that it is necessary to be Aes Sedai to become Ammerlin. Any Aes Sedai would be familiar with Tower law, but as mediators, Greys had to know the law of every land, and Bayonin took on a lecturing tone, as though explaining something that none knew as well as she. The law that sets forth how the Ammerlin is to be chosen, it merely says, the woman who is summoned, or she who stands before the hall, or the like. From beginning to end, the words Aes Sedai are mentioned not once. Never. Some might say that the intent of the framers it must be considered, but it is clear, whatever the intent of the women who wrote the law, that—" She frowned as Carlinia cut her off. "No doubt they thought it was understood to such a degree that there was no need to state it. Logically, however, a law means what it says, whatever the framers thought they meant." "Laws seldom have much concern with logic," Bayonin said acidly. "In this case, however," she conceded after a moment, "you are quite correct." To Egwene, she added, "And the hall, they see it so also." They were all serious, even Anaya, when she said, "You will be Aes Sedai, child, just as soon as you are raised Ammerlin's seat. That is the long and short of it." Even Swan, despite that tiny smile. It was a smile. "You can take the three oaths as soon as we are back in the tower," Shiriam told her. "We considered having you speak them anyway, but without the oath rod it might be taken for a sham. Best to wait." Egwene almost sat down again before catching herself. Maybe the wise ones had been right. Maybe traveling through Tel Arunriod in the flesh had done something to her mind. "This is madness," she protested. "I can't be Ammerlin. I'm... Objections piled up on her tongue in a tangle that let nothing out. She was too young. Swan herself had been the youngest Ammerlin ever, and she was 30 when raised. She had barely begun her training, no matter what she knew about the world of dreams. Ammerlins were knowledgeable and experienced, and wise. They were certainly supposed to be wise. All she felt was confounded and muddled. Most women spent 10 years as a novice and 10 as accepted. True, some moved faster, even much faster. Swan had. But she herself had been a novice less than a year, and accepted an even shorter time. It's impossible, was the best she could manage, finally. Morvryn's snort reminded her of Cerulea. "Settle yourself down, child, or I'll see to it myself. This is no time for you to grow fluttery or start fainting on us." "But I wouldn't know what to do. Not the first thing." Egwene drew a deep breath. It did not really calm her racing heart, but it helped. A little. Aiel heart. Whatever they did, she would not let them bully her. Eyeing Morvryn's bluff, hard face, she added, "She can skin me, but she can't bully me." "This is ridiculous, is what it is. I won't paint myself for a fool in front of everybody, and that is what I'd be doing. If this is why the hall summoned me, I'll tell them no." "I fear that is not an option," Anaya sighed, smoothing her robe, a surprisingly frilly thing in rose silk, with delicate ivory lace bordering every edge. "You cannot refuse a summons to become Ammerlin any more than you could a summons for trial. The words of the summons are even the same. That was heartening. Oh, yes, it was. The choice is the halls now. Mirella sounded a touch sad, which did nothing for Egwene's spirits. Suddenly smiling, Shiriam put an arm around Egwene's shoulders. Do not worry, child. We will help you and guide you. That is why we are here. Egwene said nothing. She could think of nothing to say. Maybe obeying the law was not being bullied, but it felt much the same. They took silence for assent, and she supposed it was. Without delay, Swan was sent off, grumbling at being handed the task to wake the sitters personally and let them know Egwene had arrived. The house became a whirlwind before Swan made it out the door. Egwene's riding dress came in for considerable discussion, none of which she was part of, and a plump serving woman was roused from her nap in a chair in a back room and sent off with dire warnings if she breathed a word to fetch every accepted's dress she could find that might come close to fitting Egwene. She had tried on 8, right there in the front room, before finding one that did fit after a fashion. It was too tight in the bosom, but thankfully loose in the hips. All the time the serving woman was bringing in dresses and Egwene was trying them on, Shiriam and the others took turns running out to dress themselves, and in between lectured her on what was going to happen, what she had to do and say. They made her repeat everything back. The wise ones thought saying something once was sufficient, and woe to the apprentice who failed to listen and hear. Egwene remembered some of what she had to say from a novice lecture in the tower, and she got it word perfect the first time, but the